Good evening. Welcome to Whitworth's Science and Society Lecture Series, Lecture of 2008. My name is Kamesh Sankaran. I'm in the Physics Department at Whitworth, and I also teach in the core program at Whitworth because we here believe in the value of informing citizens about the interplay between science and society. All of us realize the potential of science and technology to solve many of the challenges facing humanity, but we are also aware of the challenges of allocating finite resources. We are aware of the ethical challenges that come with new discoveries, but we are also aware of the potential to inspire us to new heights and to take us to new depths of insight about our own nature and our place in the universe. In order to understand and communicate these issues, scientists and engineers have to have the training and the inclination to play such roles. Unfortunately, most scientists do not have those roles. They'll have those desires or those inclinations. So I asked around my colleagues at NASA Marshall Space Flight Center, can you give me a name of one person who can do those things, who can talk to community members and talk about the value of the space program and the social issues involved in space exploration? And there was one name that always came up, and that was Dr. John Horak, who we have here with us tonight. Dr. John Horak got his PhD in astrophysics, where his expertise in studying gamma ray bursts, which are extraordinarily powerful explosions happening in remote corners of the universe. He is now the director of Science and Mission Systems Office at NASA Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama. In that role, he oversees 65 different NASA projects, ranging from using satellite technology to investigate how ancient Maya civilizations declined, to using NASA technology to look for life in extremely acidic conditions in the bottom of Antarctica, to taking hardware to go back to the moon, to and of course studying gamma ray bursts from distant corners of the universe. He gets numerous invitations every year to speak in various universities all over the United States. So we are just delighted that he has accepted our invitation to come to Whitworth. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome Dr. John Horak. Please give him a warm welcome.
Thank you, Dr. K. That was a very nice introduction, and you all do me a great kindness with your presence here. So thank you very much for coming out tonight and hearing a little bit about NASA. If you saw the poster said 50 cents, 50 years, and I promise you that's what we're going to talk about. But it's a play in three acts. And the first act is a little bit about the what we're doing at NASA. I will try to give you a little bit of motivation behind that, but I want to spend a little bit of time sharing with you kind of where we're going, what we're doing, what we've been doing. You probably read in the paper, are we going to retire the shuttle in 2010? Does the new rocket work? Is the Orion crew capsule too heavy? We'll talk about all of that. That's the first act. The second act I want to share with you, my personal understanding and my personal views, and hopefully something that will resonate with you about why. It's insufficient for me to come here and say, look at all the great stuff we're doing, have a good night, and you go, but why are we doing this? And then the third part, I hope it'll be partly up to you. We can have a little dialogue, question and answer session. You guys can share with me anything that strikes you from what we talk about tonight, what we share, and any other questions like what are we going to do with the Hubble Space Telescope and how's Mars Science Lab going, those kinds of things are all fair game. But first, a little bit of what we're up to at NASA and where we think we're going. Now, it may seem incredulous to many people, but NASA is a part of the federal government. We don't get to do whatever we want. We don't get to go to work and dream up cool things to do, and then somehow a miracle happens and money shows up, and the next thing you know, we're walking around on Venus. It doesn't happen that way. NASA is a part of the executive branch of the federal government. So I work for a man. His name is David King. He's the center director at the Marshall Space Flight Center. He works for the administrator of NASA, Michael Griffin. Michael Griffin works for the president of the United States. We do what we are told, just like everyone else in America. And we have been asked, through the expression of the United States space policy, to do several things. And they're on the screen up there. And the first thing you see is safely fly the space shuttle until 2010. And that's what we intend to do. Our current plan calls us to fly out the 10. 10 is a number somewhere between 9 and 11. Remaining flights for the space shuttle, which includes a mission to the Hubble Space Telescope to, again, service the telescope, upgrade its instruments, repair the computer that failed recently, finish the completion of the space station, and then retire the shuttle. How long have we been flying the space shuttle? Do you know? Does anybody know when the first flight of the space shuttle was, month and year? April of 1981. You're very close. Right. This is the anniversary of Yuri Gagarin's flight. That's 27 years ago. The first shuttle launch was closer in time to the first person going into space than it is right now. How many of you drive a 27-year-old car? That says more about you than I read it, but that's next week's talk. Trying to find parts for a 27-year-old car. Trying to make sure that a vehicle that goes 17,500 miles an hour from 0 to 5 miles a second in 8 minutes is going to work. It becomes more and more and more and more difficult as time goes on. We also have a finite budget. We want to build a new transportation system, but we can't build a new transportation system under a finite budget until we retire the costs associated with the current one. So the current plan is to finish flying the shuttle safely 2010. We can argue about whether that's fiscal year 2010, calendar year 2010, but okay, put a picture frame around it. Second thing we're going to do is we're going to finish the International Space Station. I mentioned that. We have very serious commitments to international partners with whom we have integrated to put the space station on orbit. I would encourage you to go on the Internet and find out when it flies over. When you see it fly over, you'll never forget it. It's the brightest thing in the sky. Brighter than Jupiter, brighter than Venus. You can see it from horizon to horizon. Take your children out and look at it. It's fantastic. We need to do this, and we need to balance exploration and scientific research. We need to have an integrated portfolio of humans exploring and robots exploring. It's important to send scientists to the International Space Station so they can use their mind and their bodies to do research. And it's important to have things like the Chandra X-ray Observatory so scientists on the ground can take their minds places their bodies simply can't go. We need to balance that. And so there will be debates and discussions about how much science, how much human exploration, but we need to maintain a balance. We want to develop and fly something called the Orion Crew Exploration Vehicle. I'll talk about that. It looks a lot like the Apollo capsule. It's a lot bigger. Apollo capsule carried 3 people. This could carry up to 6. It needs a new rocket. We don't have a Saturn 1B. We don't have a Saturn 5 anymore, so we need to develop a new rocket to go underneath that. We want to go to the moon. We want to go back to the moon. Gene Cernan was the last human to set foot on the moon in December of 1972. How many people in this room were born after 1972? Let the record show that 95% of the people in the room raised their hand, and I think that's a shame. I remember what it was like when people were walking on the moon. The world came to a standstill. I was telling folks that during Apollo 11, for some strange reason, our neighborhood, we were compelled to take our television sets in the backyard so that we could see the moon and the TV sort of at the same time. I don't know why we did that, but I remember we did that. Any event that makes you do that, behave kind of in that twisted way, how important must that be? The world literally stopped. It was an amazing time. And since we want to go to the moon and since we want to service the space station at the same time, we will have to make compromises about the rockets we build. But I'll talk about that as well. We want to promote international and commercial partnerships and exploration. The government simply on the back of the taxpayer can't afford to do everything we need to do without commercial involvement and international partnerships. And there are many, many more good reasons for international partnerships than just economic reasons. But this kind of lays out where we want to go. Dr. Griffin, next steps in returning to the moon and moving on to Mars, the near-Earth asteroids are crucial in deciding the course of future space exploration. We must understand that these steps are incremental, cumulative, and incredibly powerful in their effect. One of the things Mike Griffin's trying to say here is that this is not a parlor trick. We're not trying to just go to the moon because, well, we think it would be cool and we could show off and tell people about it. And then we'll be done. We are trying to build a multi-generational sustainable capability for the nation. Think about the interstate highway system. Think about the Transcontinental Railroad. Think about the nation's airline infrastructure, but don't think too much about flying because I know that's painful. But the point is, we're trying to build transportation capability that's a long-term asset for the nation, not just something you go do six times and are done. So I want to share with you some thoughts from some people that work in the agency. I'll let this roll. It's about 5-6 minutes of video. I want you to get the idea here that we're not just talking about things that are we're thinking about doing. We're actually building and cutting hardware so that maybe your son or your daughter or your grandchild will be the next person to be able to put a footprint there, right next to Gene Cernan's. Gene is getting old, and I'd like to think that we'll be able to send someone back before his time comes so that he can see what we're able to do. That's Harrison Schmitt. He's the only scientist, only trained scientist ever to walk on the moon. He's a trained geologist. He served in the Senate from state of New Mexico, and he liked to get dirty. That was Apollo 17.
It has been a beginning. It is a beginning. I don't think there ever will be an end, not as long as man is alive and willing.
Constellation is just the name of the program within the agency, if you're wondering what
Constellation that is. NASA's program to return humans to exploring beyond low Earth orbit.
We've
begun with the end in mind of exploring Mars and understanding what is it that we need to learn between now and then in order to be able to do that safely and effectively. We have three different, what we refer to as design reference missions. The first one is servicing the International Space Station. Insert into orbit, rendezvous and dock with the International Space Station, stay up to 180 days or more at the International Space Station, and then return that crew to the surface of the Earth. Design reference mission number two would be to do a 7-day mission to the moon. Design reference mission number three is sort of a combination of those first two, because we're doing essentially the same functions that are in the space station mission and in the lunar 7-day mission, but now we're having crews stay on the lunar surface for up to 6 months at a lunar outpost. We have a very rich heritage of human and
exploration
of the solar system.
That's John Young.
The extent of our reach was the moon in generations past with humans. Constellation is about reaching beyond that point ultimately.
The Orion system is basically the capsule and the supporting system that will get the crew into space, into docking with the ISS, and eventually onto the moon. So that's where the crew sits. That's where the crew does its job. On Apollo, we had a capsule shape, and in that mission also we were going to the moon. This is different now because the mission on the moon is different. We're now going global access on the moon, meaning we want to be able to go to the poles where we might find the ice and those kind of things, which will help us sustain ourselves there longer. To do that requires a different vehicle, right? More propellant than we had on Apollo. We also want to be able, when we're on the moon, to have a sufficient crew to actually do a lot more EVAs to get out there and actually do work. So that's why we're sending four people to the surface. So given those two changes, this Orion system is much different than Apollo as far as the size and the other capabilities. Now to get Orion in orbit, you need a booster. So that's Ares 1.
The Ares 1 is what we call the crew launch vehicle. It's made up of a first stage, which is derived from the Space Shuttle solid rocket booster, except it uses an extra fifth segment, and with a liquid oxygen, liquid hydrogen upper stage powered by a J2 engine, which is a derivative of the old J2 engine that flew on the Saturn V. The Ares V is our heavy lifter.
It's 370 feet tall.
This vehicle can lift 6 times the cargo anything on this planet can lift today. It's got the same solid rocket booster surrounding a liquid oxygen, liquid hydrogen core stage, which is double the size of the external tank today. And it has an upper stage as well. We call it an Earth departure stage. That does 2 things. One, it takes the lander into low Earth orbit. And after that docks with the Orion, which is what the Ares 1 takes to orbit, it does one final burn and injects the stack on its way to the moon.
The Lunar Lander is part of the Constellation program. It has a mission of taking 4 people back to the surface of the moon. In this architecture, the crew is actually launched separately from the lander. You launch the crew in the Orion vehicle on Ares 1, and you launch separately the Earth departure stage and the lander on Ares 5. Both of those go into low Earth orbit. The Earth departure stage and the lander rendezvous with the Orion vehicle in low Earth orbit. At that point, the Earth departure stage does a translunar initiation burn, and we go to lunar orbit. You drop the EDS stage along the way, and you end up in lunar orbit with the lander and the Orion vehicle. And at that point, they separate. The lander goes down to the surface of the moon. We leave the descent stage on the surface of the moon when our mission is done.
It's a 3.5-4-story building that just landed on the moon.
We re-rendezvous with the Orion vehicle, and then we expend the ascent stage. We have 3 different missions. We have 1 mission, which is the sortie mission, and it takes 4 people to the surface of the moon for 7 days. They actually live out of the lander in that mission. We have a 2nd reference mission, which is an outpost mission. And in that mission, the lander takes the crew to the surface of the moon, but the crew then lives out of the outpost. In that mission, the lander actually sits dormant for approximately 6 months. The 3rd mission is the cargo mission. That is an uncrewed mission. It's an automated lander, and that's what you would use to bring heavy cargo to the surface of the moon.
You look at some of the choices we've made in the systems we've chosen, the solid motor from the shuttle, the upper stage engine from Apollo, as starting points for what we are going to build. That gives us a great advantage. So what we see going on here in the early part of the program, with the test firings and the different things that we're doing, much of that is to anchor our analytical models and the design tools we use to then go and improve the design in key areas. We have every center of NASA's team engaged in this program at nearly every level. I've been incredibly impressed with the depth of talent this agency has to offer. And we're taking that and we're applying it to the really tough problems of Constellation, of exploration, of being able to actually push out to the frontier.
So Jeff and Mark are great because they're both St. Louis Cardinals fans. They have other good attributes, too. I'm a big St. Louis Cardinal fan. So these are real people building real hardware. So why the moon? A little bit. So now you kind of get a picture of how we're going back and that hopefully that we're not just thinking about it. We're cutting metal. Why the moon? Well, it's nearby. It only takes us about 3 days to get there. It's nearly as accessible as where most of the communication satellites operate, at least in terms of the amount of energy required. when I got my pilot's license, I was a little frustrated in the beginning because I always would take off at this airport north of Huntsville, and I would go to this place called the Northeast Practice Area. And you'd fly around, and you'd learn how to stall the airplane and recover the airplane, and we'd always come back and land at the very same airport. And this went on for months. It seemed like years, but for months. And finally, when I had, I mean, you know, it was almost like I was literally going practicing flying. But if you make a mistake practicing flying, you still make a smoking hole in the ground. And you don't want to do that. Now I can use the airplane to go places and do all kinds of things. This is sort of like our Northeast practice area. Remember what Mr. Hanley said. We're trying to start with the idea of going to Mars. That's a lot to do right away. The first time I got in an airplane, I did not fly from my house to go see my parents in St. Louis. That was not what we wanted to do. We found a practice area. In many ways, the moon is a practice area. It's nearby. It's extremely relevant. It's alien, but it's familiar. You can still see the Earth, depending on where you're standing. 6 months to not see the Earth, that's a very interesting test to try to give a crew of people. We don't have to build completely new launch systems. We can derive launch systems from what we have to help us go back to the moon. You can read these as well as I can. But the point is that the moon is the first place we want to go, and there are some very good reasons why we want to go there. We've been there, but we haven't been there before in any great measure. We have landed humans 6 times on the moon. 12 people have walked on the moon, and the places they landed are these little squares up here with 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, and 16. And you can see they're all sort of on one side and all in the equatorial regions of the moon. As a rule of thumb, the moon has about the same amount of surface area as Africa. So imagine you drop out of a helicopter in 6 random places in Africa. You know all about it, right? No, not really. There are many, many interesting places we want to go on the moon. South Pole Aiken Basin floor is particularly interesting. It's one of the largest crater impact areas known in the solar system. It's on the other side and on the back. We've never been to the back. There are a lot of interesting places left to explore. If you look at spatially where we landed in Apollo, the 6 places we landed, and just plop them down to the same scale on the United States, that's where they are. Dallas, Lubbock, Sheboygan, Wisconsin, the football, Pro Football Hall of Fame, somewhere on the Ocoee River to watch kayaking in Tennessee or North Georgia, Montgomery, Alabama. You'd never see Spokane. You'd never see the Rocky Mountains. You'd never see the Grand Canyon. You wouldn't see the Arch in St. Louis. You wouldn't see France. You wouldn't see penguins. You wouldn't find polar bears. Think of all the things you wouldn't see if that was your view of just the United States. You'd miss most of the picture. When are we going to do this? We will have a gap. We will have a gap between the time the shuttle retires and we are able to fly the Ares rockets with the Orion crew on top. That gap is going to be about 4 years, maybe longer. 2014, 2015 is what we're looking at for the operability of the Ares, these red arrows here, to take people up and down just to the space station. So that's just simply to replace in some way the capability we have today with the shuttle. That'll be followed by the Ares 5, hopefully with the Earth Departure Stage and Altair that puts people on the moon no sooner than 10 years from now. Okay, this is a long-term project, and as I said upstairs earlier, It's a 20-year project on an annual funding cycle, and that creates certain challenges. I have some techie charts. There are techies in the audience. I won't make you remember all of the details, but I want to point out a couple things. Just to give you an idea of the relative size of the space shuttle, the Ares 1 rocket that we'll send the crew on, the Ares 5 rocket, which will send the cargo and meet up with the crew, and then the Saturn V, which hopefully you have at least some passing familiarity with. The shuttle's 56 meters tall, multiplied by 3.1, so you know, it's 170 feet, 180 feet high. The Ares 1 is almost twice that height. It will take about the same total mass to orbit as the shuttle in terms of payload, roughly 25 metric tons, and that's all in the white part above the brown upper stage. We are going to reuse the solid rocket booster in a sense. We're going to redesign it, add another segment, but hardware that flies today on the space shuttle will fly as a part of that. The Ares 5 is much bigger. It's 116 meters high. It's 6 meters taller than the Saturn V, 20 feet taller than the Saturn V. And if you can read the chart here, it's somewhere between 30 and 50%, again, as much lift capacity. This is a huge vehicle. This is a huge vehicle. And scientists are thinking about what else they could do with that. So, for example, with one launch, you could launch a telescope with five times the collecting area of the Hubble Space Telescope. One launch. Enormous capability. Send, 35 metric tons to Neptune and orbit, just all kinds of capability opens up. It's not simply just a scaling up of what we're doing now. It's a complete transformation of how we think about putting things in space. The entire country is working on this. You can't go anywhere in the nation and not find somebody. I think that's an overstatement. There's 47 or 48 states are involved in the construction of Ares. So, yeah, if you tested me on that, you probably could go find somebody that's not working on it. But my point is that this rocket belongs to the country, and the country's involved. Some details about what the rocket looks like. I mentioned it has a solid rocket booster on the bottom. This middle part is fueled by liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. It's the same fuel that we use today in the space shuttle main engine, except this engine is a derivative of the engine that we used on the Saturn V called the J2. It's a very powerful engine. It can be restarted, which is a useful capability. It can be restarted in space. You can turn it off, turn it back on. With the space shuttle main engines, you turn them on, you can't really just go back, turn them off, and turn them back on again. You got to pull them out. You got to dry them. You got to refurbish them. You got to put them back in. This engine can be restarted. Just kind of an idea of the numbers associated with the cost. All of this has been contracted. ATK in Utah, not next door, but on this side of the country, that's roughly a $2 billion effort just for the booster. This J2 engine, Pratt & Whitney Rocketdyne, $1.2 billion. Boeing will produce the upper stage. This is a NASA in-house design. They will also produce the instrument ring, that little washer-looking piece up there. That's $800 million. That's the computer for the rocket. That's where all the guidance and navigation and control is. And then the Orion crew exploration vehicle at the top is Lockheed Martin's, and that's their job to produce that for the Johnson Space Center in Texas. I won't go through all of this. I just want to point out with these charts that we are cutting hardware. We're actually building pieces of the first flight vehicle, the Ares 1X test flight, which will come up next year. And I will show you a little bit about what that looks like. This will be in 2009. Next year, the very first flight of this vehicle. It's not a full-up vehicle. It doesn't have all the bells and whistles and power steering and cruise control and power windows. But we're going to fly a vehicle that will look, it will have the same outer profile, same aerodynamic profile. The bottom part of the rocket is obviously live, as you can see on the movie. And the top is a mass simulator. It takes a long time to build an upper stage. But we want to understand, what does it take to stack this vehicle? We're stacking something twice as tall as the shuttle. We haven't done that at the Kennedy Space Center since the 1970s. So almost literally nobody there working has stacked a vehicle this tall. It's a very different kind of vehicle to fly because, for example, it's a pencil compared to the shuttle, which is much more non-symmetric about the long axis. If you spin this thing, it's symmetric about the long axis. Shuttle's not like that. We control the roll of the shuttle with the engines. This has one engine at the bottom, so how do I control the roll? I need to build a roll control package so that it aligns itself properly as it goes downrange. That has to be put on. That has to be flown. If you watched the SpaceX, the third flight of SpaceX, which was not successful, it was not successful because they failed to properly separate the two stages, something that's really hard to test in a wind tunnel or in a computer. We want to understand the dynamics of separating the stages. And then just like the shuttle, the solid rocket booster will come back. It'll come back. It'll splash into the ocean. We want to understand the dynamics of recovering that from a different launch configuration and test out new parachutes, new kind of thermal protection systems, and these kinds of things. It's important to get that hardware back because every time we fly, we get to cut it open and see how it worked. Used to be you'd throw a rocket up, shoot it off, and it would go into the Indian Ocean, and that would be the end of it. But every time we fly a space shuttle, we get two of these back. The ability to go back and take them apart tells us a great deal about what our manufacturing consistency is, to make sure that number 200 looks just like number 100, and that we are building hardware that is safe to fly. So there you see the splashdown. This is going to be sometime in 2009. I can't give you the exact date because it depends on the Hubble Space Telescope launch. We have two launch pads at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida for human spaceflight. And after the Columbia accident, it was mandated that we would always have a shuttle ready during a mission in case we damaged the heat shield, let's say, on the way up, and we needed to send a rescue mission. Now, when we go to the space station, and in fact, that's the only place the shuttle has been since the Columbia accident, is the space station, we don't necessarily have to have that shuttle sitting right there ready to go, figuratively, 10 minutes later, a couple days later, because the astronauts can hang out on the space station for a while. They have some lifeboat capability. When we go to the Hubble Space Telescope, we don't have that. And so if we get up into orbit and we realize the shuttle's been damaged, we need to have another shuttle there ready to go. So both pads are occupied for the Hubble mission. The second pad is the one that we want to use for this test flight. So we got to get to Hubble first, get there safely, repair it, and get down, and then we can turn over that secondary launch pad. Hardware is being built. This upper left-hand movie is a picture of rolling some steel at the Glenn Research Center. I figured, you know, everybody's got to have a welder in their presentation. So there you go. I mean, the idea here is that this hardware is being built. It will be followed by the Orion Crew Exploration Vehicle and the Altair Lunar Lander. Again, I don't know if it's important to you that it's 115.8 cubic meters of space. Compare that to your Toyota Corolla. But it's 80% larger than Apollo, and it's 5 meters in diameter. All right, so 5 meters is about 16 feet. 3, 6, 9, 12, 15. All right, so that's the diameter of this thing. We are talking very, very large pieces of hardware to carry people into space. Very complicated, but we're on our way. That's the lunar lander I mentioned. That's a 3 or 4 story building. 7 days stay on the surface, or up to 6 months. As we rotate crew back and forth from the outpost. They will get there on a rocket called the Ares V. This is just a big rocket. It's the biggest rocket ever built, huge. I won't go into the technical details, but suffice it to say that when it goes off from the launch pad in Florida, a lot of people will be watching because it will be hard to miss. So we're going to the moon, and we're going to the moon and beyond for lots of reasons. That's Act Two. Why are we going to go? Some of them are up there. Encourage inspiration, innovation, and discovery. We can quibble with that if you want. I think it's important for the nation to go beyond the current capability of sending people up and down to low Earth orbit. How far up, if anybody knows, how far up do you think we go with the space shuttle? 1,000 miles? 10,000 miles? How high? Somewhere between 100 and 400 miles, depending on the activity. So in many cases, sometimes the shuttle launches, and it never gets further from the surface of the Earth than you are from Seattle. You can drive there and back in the day. At some point, that ceases to be exploration. And I think we're well past that point. I think most people in the space program believe we're well past that point. We have expanded low Earth orbit into our sphere of influence. Astronauts used to come to the Marshall Space Flight Center after a mission wearing their Mach 25 patches. Wish I had one. Lots of people do, but they're great. What does that mean? It's like, I got in. I rode the rocket. I got in. I went 25 times the speed of sound. I touched space, and I came back. And now they wear a different patch. Same shape, same color, and if you're not looking carefully, you miss it. It's got a 100 on it. It means I lived 100 days in space. The difference of saying, you know, I went to Paris for the weekend, or I lived in Paris. So we have incorporated low Earth orbit into our sphere of influence, and I think for the nation, it's time for us to move on. We are starting to design and build these vehicles. using extensive lessons learned to minimize cost, technical, and schedule risk. It's a government chart, okay. The point is, we're on track, and the team is making progress for the first flight of Ares in 2009. So that's a little bit about what? Act one is over. You can stand up if you want for 5 seconds and then sit back down. We'll start Act two. Because Act two is questions, and I have the first one. And that's why. Why are we doing this? We've seen a lot. Some cool video. Two Cardinal fans. Steve Cook's from the University of Minnesota. From the Big Ten, I might add. That's a good thing. Descriptions from the project manager, evidence of hardware really coming together. And all of this amounts to a lot about what we're being asked to do. Everything to this point is what. And I want to talk about why. Or as I say in Missouri, how come? This is what I want to focus on in Act 2, the second part of the evening. And it's the one thing that we at NASA struggle very, very mightily to articulate. The answer to the question, why? I've heard a lot of answers to this question. I've been at NASA since 1987, with the exception of 5 years in the middle. And I've given a lot of answers to the question. They come in categories. There are flavors of answers. There's the marketing answer. To inspire the next generation of explorers as only NASA can. I've tried to do my movie trailer voice there, but I don't really have one. There's the philosophical, sort of because exploration is in our DNA, whatever that means. There's an economic argument that says, just look at the spin-offs. But we always talk about the ancillary benefit, never the core benefit. It's always because it has great secondary collateral benefit. And a lot of times we answer the question, why, with what? Throw a microphone in front of an engineer at NASA and ask them, why are you doing this? And they'll say, it's to improve our injection capacity to TLI by 30% and enable 4 people to access the surface of the moon anywhere and return anytime with a stay of up to 6 months. That's why. And you're laughing, and so would I, because all of those answers, they strike me as pretty feeble, especially when you talk about how much money is being spent and the fact that it's discretionary money. It's money the nation does not have to spend. We don't have to have a space program. We choose to have a space program. But if we don't get this answer right, and if I don't get this answer right in places far beyond the communities I normally talk to, we're never going to get a chance to go do this. We won't get a chance to go do anything you've seen today. So why are we doing this? What's the point? And when people ask me this, I have a simple answer. And that's this. Space exploration through NASA is the best tool this nation has to create the world we want. And usually the immediate rejoinder is, you can't afford it, especially now. Did you see what the stock market's doing? See the price of gas? And when I get that answer, I say this. There's only one thing we can't afford, and that's to stop investing in the future. Now, the investment is not going to be immense. It's not going to be everything we want, but it must be there. And to me, it must include, and I don't think we have a choice, but to include a robust space program infused with scientific and human exploration. So why invest? And I think the answer to that is pretty straightforward. If you want to abandon investment in the future of the country, you have given up. Are you really ready to accept the premise that America is just going to go away? Do you think there's no tomorrow? Are you going to tell your children that? Are you going to admit somehow that the nation has zero hope for a brighter future? Because unless the answer to any of those is yes, you're going to have to find a way to continue to invest. Because there is going to be a tomorrow. And the history of the United States in many ways shows why you need to invest to maintain your sense of purpose about the future, especially in the face of hardship. Living in Alabama, the Civil War is something we never get away from. I would argue it was the most difficult time the country has ever seen, in the middle of a terrible 4-year war, which was fought on our own soil, where nearly every casualty, regardless of what side, was an American. Everything being destroyed was American. Lincoln had some choices. He could have focused everything, every dollar, every person, every piece of capital on just winning the war or ending the war or just preserving some kind of nation, and he nearly did. He even said, my goal is to save the Union. But that was not his goal exclusively, because the Union also had to be worth saving. In that most challenging time, he found a way in 1863 to start the construction of a transcontinental railroad completed in 1869. This was a huge, enormous financial and logistical infrastructure investment in the future of a nation he was trying to preserve with no guarantee he would actually prevail. For Lincoln to simply try to preserve the nation in the face of the greatest threat to its existence before or since was just not enough. Contrary to any admission of no hope or no future for the nation, his careful investment made in hard times, his sense of purpose about the future in the face of huge adversity, it actually made the future all that more worth preserving. And I don't think our situation today is all that different. The investments that we can make now, especially in the face of present challenges, can actually make the future of the nation more worthwhile than would have otherwise been the case. So why space exploration at NASA? Because in areas of public policy, especially in the federal government, when asked the question, why anything, the answer is almost invariably to prevent X, where X is some kind of negative outcome. I'm campaigning for Joe because Fred's a jerk, and I don't want Fred to get elected. That's what motivates me. I'm bailing out banks to preserve or prevent a recession. Maybe I'll be right, maybe I won't. Now, preventing negative outcomes is fine. Sometimes it's really important. I'm all for preventing terrorists from entering the country, for example. But not everything you can do, not everything you do can be steeped in avoiding a negative outcome. You also have to actively pursue some positive outcomes. A deficit approach can't be your only strategy. And said another way, we can't save our way to prosperity, because a world you settle for is not the world you want. I played soccer for 20, 25 years, and I played on lots of teams that were very good defensively, and they just couldn't score goals. I was a goaltender. We played well, we played hard, and we played primarily to prevent the negative outcome of having the other team score on us. And it seems in retrospect we lost every game 1-0. It is very tiring to play defense for 90 minutes. No matter how hard you play, you will not win. The best you can do is tie. NASA is one of the few places where the nation can truly play offense. We can score some goals for ourselves in the most positive sense of the word. It's a place where we can create upside, not just eliminate downside. It's a place where we can talk about and, more importantly, act upon the world we want to build. NASA's not in the business of preventing anything. We can't make a law. Did you know that? NASA's not a regulatory agency. We can't pass a law if NASA says you can't do this. We have no statutory regulation power at all. We don't prevent anything. The purpose of our work is not about eliminating any particular negative. NASA is entirely upside. We exist to create, to build, to plant, and to invest. Dr. Griffin, the administrator of NASA, recently described space exploration as the act of buying options for our children. Space exploration with NASA is among the best means we can use to buy these options to actively create the world we want for them. So now we get to the 50 cents, 50 years part. I know you've been waiting for that. If you don't believe that space exploration, and exploration, in fact, of any kind, but space exploration has been one of the most important drivers of our country and is creator of the very fabric of the world we have today, I want you to take the change out of your pocket. Tell me what you got. Sift the change out of your pocket. You don't carry change anymore? Everybody has a debit card. Okay. Somebody's got some change. Throw away everything except the quarters. Actually, put everything except the quarters on the table. Take the quarters out. I don't know if you collect the state quarter series, or if you noticed that the backs of quarters have things other than the eagle on them now. They have other things. This is the This is the 10th year of this, so if you don't know this has been going on, I will have to wake you up because you've been asleep since 1998. I've got four. This is just the four I happen to have. I have Mississippi, I have Nebraska, I have Minnesota, and I have Oregon. And notice I said Minnesota, because if you're from Minnesota, that's how you say Minnesota. Take a look at what you got. My kids collect these. This is the 50th anniversary of NASA. The 50th quarter will be issued this year from the state of Hawaii, the 50th state. And they're interesting. Look at them. They're very interesting. You carry them around every day. I swear you haven't looked at them the way you're about to look at them now. I think these 50 pixels, they illustrate the nation. In aggregating these 50 snapshots, we have a very complete, if not detailed, picture of what the nation has become since our founding. Each of these 50 quarters, they're vignettes of things that actually happened. They actually happened as a result of the formation of the country. This narrative of our nation, the story of who we have become and the future that was created to be our present, the place we live today, expressed 25 cents at a time, it has exploration as an incredibly prominent theme. Anybody have Florida? What's on the back of Florida? Does anybody know? Space shuttle. And the word discovery. Does anybody have Maine or Virginia or Rhode Island? They all have sailing ships. The word discovery actually appears twice on two different sets. If you're from Wisconsin, it has the typical German gestalt. It has the word forward in big block letters so that, you know, stamp it on your head. We're going forward. There is no subtlety in that message whatsoever. My home state is Missouri. It has Lewis and Clark and the Corps of Discovery paddling up the Missouri River. There's one man-made object that appears twice. Does anybody know what it is? Some of you do, but be quiet. One man-made object, one human-made object that appears twice. The Wright Brothers Flyer. It's on the back of North Carolina. It's on the back of Ohio. And what else is on the back of Ohio? A moonwalking astronaut. Now, as an ensemble, I have no way to argue anything other than the fact that these 50 snapshots are a view of what the nation has become in 225 years. They're a tangible view of things that became reality because of our history, the risks we took, the investments we made, and the sacrifices that a lot of people endured. It's a view you carry around in your pocket every day, mostly without thinking. Now, where I live out in Alabama, Helen Keller is on the quarter. And my question to you is, what will be on the back of your quarter the next time? The next time the nation decides to issue another special back of the quarter series, what's going to be on it? Or what's going to be on the back of any quarter for that matter? Now, I could be wrong. I am often. My children make sure that I am a lot. But I can't see how just about anything that we call important today will ever make it to the back of the next set of state quarters. Hannah Montana? She's got the same name as a state. Why wouldn't they put her on their quarter? Y'all laugh, right? She's not going to make it. I'm sorry. She's not going to make it. Bill Gates? We don't have John D. Rockefeller. We don't have Andrew Carnegie. Why would Gates be on the back of a quarter? Warren Buffett? Matt Hasselbeck? Certainly not Ty Willingham. But I could see an Aries 5. Or I could see the imprint of a human outpost on the moon. Whatever winds up on the back of the next set, it'll be the product of the national narrative that you and I are charged to write and to bring into being. And I think that among the best tools at our disposal to write that national narrative is investment in space exploration at NASA to create whatever future you want. Clearly, the nation has had plenty of things in the past national narrative that don't go on the back of quarters. Major things, like human slavery, or the plight of the continent's indigenous people. And lesser things, like Teapot Dome, Watergate, the rationale behind starting the Mexican-American War, or the stock market crash of 1929. Those don't go on backs of quarters. We don't put those on the back of quarters. They're part of our national narrative. But these other things, the parts of the narrative that aren't positive, they're not unique to the past. We got lots today. Home mortgage crisis, drugs, drug abuse, low science, math, education test scores. We have a lower life expectancy than most of Western Europe. And gasoline that's recently been $4 a gallon. But the lesson for us in looking at the back of the state quarter series is not that the nation didn't have problems or things about which not to be proud back then, but that while working on those problems, the nation also found a way to invest for the future, committed itself to a bold, positive, and sweeping set of outcomes, many of which were simply unimaginable, and actually made them happen to improve the condition of life on Earth for us and for those who will follow us. Space exploration at NASA is among the best tools we have at our disposal for creating actively the future we want for ourselves. Investment in the National Program of Space Exploration is an unambiguous way not only to show ourselves, but the entire world, that we maintain a very serious sense of purpose about our nation's future, especially in times of hardship. Space exploration is something the entire world understands, no matter what language you speak. It demonstrates conclusively your nation's attitude, posture, and preparedness for tomorrow. To be a spacefaring nation says, we plan to be here tomorrow, and we plan to be here in ways that are better than today for our people and for those who will come after us. You saw the goal that I put up there on the very first slide. Finish the shuttle, build Ares 1, fly Orion, finish the space station, better understand our place in the cosmos through science, take human presence beyond low Earth orbit. We didn't establish these outcomes because the Dow was at 14,000, but because they are worthwhile creative acts to help secure a better future for ourselves and those who will inherit the nation. They are the act of creating for tomorrow a world we want, not a world we settle for. Now, the financial realities of our time will likely change the path we have to take, or the path that we have envisioned to realize these outcomes. But the realities don't change the importance or value of the goals. They don't eliminate a future for the country. The hardships, in fact, can hone and refine our sense of purpose. They can force a rededication to investments that are not simply aimed at avoiding negative outcomes, but are acts of value creation. And in Lincoln's example, we should recognize these acts, when coupled to a strong sense of purpose in the future, they can make the future you want to bring about even more worthwhile. I see no better place to do this than within the context of the nation's space program, because I see the space program as one of the best tools we have available to create a positive future for the nation. So that's how I answer the question, why? That's my answer. You may have other answers. And that's the end of Act 2. Now, Act 3 belongs to you. I'll talk. I'll sing. Probably not a good idea. I want to hear your thoughts. I don't know how often people from NASA come here, so you can say, hey, I have a question. And I'll be happy to answer any questions you have. Yes, sir.
I have a question. The question is, what's the plan to loop around the moon and explore? What's the lunar exploration vehicle going to be?
Okay.
Is that lunar module thing able to fly around and on different parts of the moon?
Yeah, the question, yeah, I'll repeat the question. Question is, I might paraphrase it. If I don't paraphrase it correctly, let me know. What's the plan once you get there to move around on the moon? We saw John Young. He was also the guy that flew the first space shuttle. And if you ever want to meet somebody who defines the word brave, meet the man who flew on a Titan, flew on the Saturn V twice, and was the first guy to climb in the space shuttle. We didn't have a test flight of the space shuttle. We flew. First time we flew it, we put people in it. He said, I'll get in the left seat. He's a hero. The question is, how are we going to move around on the moon? And you saw the lunar rover. We are still working that. I can tell you that the lunar lander is not going to hop up and fly over and land and hop up and fly over and land, you simply can't afford it from an energetic perspective. The cost in terms of how much rocket you need to get a molecule to the moon simply makes hopping around on the moon on that scale not practical. The other thing is, it's a 3.5-story building. You want to land it once. And then you don't want to fly it again because you might not be as successful, lifting it and flying it again. You want to land it and then be done with it. So how are we going to get around? I think human legs were shown to be very effective on the moon. If you don't mind moving around like this, it's okay. It looks a little silly, but it works. And then we will have other mobility solutions that will include both human-driven rovers, wheeled vehicles, and also probably mobility solutions, little robots, that assist and work in conjunction with the crew on the surface. But the jury's out still on what those designs look like. We have some designs at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, something called the Athlete Vehicle, which is, it looks like a cross between something made in Peoria, Illinois, at the Caterpillar facility, and the highest tech robot you've ever seen in a movie. It's sort of the cross-pollination of those two things. It kind of rolls around, it has legs, and it can move very, very large, heavy or massive, 1/6 as heavy, it's the same mass here as on the moon, around on the surface. Mobility is very important. Imagine your frustration if you had to land on the moon and this was how you had to explore. Okay, time to go. I mean, people are going to want to walk around, pick up rocks, go places, move regolith, and these kinds of things. But people will walk, and people will roll. I doubt we will fly on the moon. We might fly on Mars, but probably not with people. Maybe ballooning on Mars is a pretty cool idea. You can't balloon on the moon because there's no atmosphere. So, yes, sir. Well, question is, it's a huge production to get off the surface of the Earth. How are you going to get off the surface of Mars once you get there? All right, there's a couple ways you could do that, but all of them involve taking with you and landing the rocket you need to get back. Okay, we do that on the moon. We did that on the moon. The lunar module actually had sort of three pieces. It had the structure at the bottom, the legs. It had the the engines compartment, propulsion things, and then there was a piece that came down, and then there was a piece that came off. And you saw that in the video, Apollo 17 blasting off, they left a large part of the lunar module sitting on the moon, and they just took off in the little part. So when we went to the moon, we took back with us the rocket that we used to get back off the moon. We have to do that with Mars as well. It's very unlikely, however, that you will launch directly from the surface of Mars all the way back to the Earth. You'll probably leave something in Mars orbit. You'll have to launch from the surface of Mars, phase your orbit, hook up with that, and then fire a next engine to come home. If that sounds complicated, there's a reason why. Because it is. I mean, it's incredibly complex. It's, you're looking at a kind of, 2-year-ish journey, locked in a can, with those three people sitting next to you. And you cannot escape. There's nowhere to go. If you call for help, it's 20 minutes before I even hear it. And there's no aborting the mission. There's no coming home. Everything you eat, you either got to take or you got to grow on the way. Everything you get rid of, you need to figure out a way to reuse that. You can't just pile up your trash or other things. Maybe you can make the fuel for the return trip on the surface of Mars. That's something we'll look at. Mars is largely carbon dioxide. Maybe you can split the CO2, somehow bind the C to H, and make methane. That's rocket fuel. Oh, and by the way, the byproduct was oxygen. Great. Maybe we can come home. But going to Mars is very complicated. It's almost impossible to do without an Ares V, without a heavy lift capability. I saw you, and then I'll go you, and then I'll get over there too.
Is there another possibility of having another space station but closer to Mars to help assist those people there?
Is there a possibility of having another space station in addition to the one we have,
yes,
but closer to Mars? I suppose it's possible. I know of no plans to do such a thing. I know of no plans to have a space station, for example, at the Lagrange point, which is sort of a, there are five of these things. You can kind of hang out in equilibrium. It takes very little fuel to maintain your place in space. We have sort of enough on our plate at the moment, you know, welding things in Cleveland and getting them down to Florida and those kinds of things. But the goal of all of this is to enable and begin a process by which something like that could be brought into being. We want to get people out of low Earth orbit and go interesting and cool places. All right, and I said you, and then I'm going to come. Maybe you should pick the questioners. But all right, let's go here and here, and then you can pick. It's more like parallel parking, because the gravitational field of an asteroid is very, 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 very small. And so it's actually very hard to land on an asteroid. You sort of have to kind of sneak up next to it and then, you know, land. It's not, you can't, you know, you're not doing this. We have some experience with that. We have landed robotic spacecraft on an asteroid, and the Japanese have a sort of asteroid sample return mission. We have done that. Humans have done that. It's actually really hard to orbit an asteroid because it's very, very lumpy. It's like the gravitational field of a potato with rocks stuck inside. You just, you know, you have to be very careful, otherwise you crash. What is the point of landing on an asteroid? Well, it's pretty cool. If you ever want to, the best known laboratories, she asked, what's the point of landing on an asteroid? The best known laboratories for analyzing materials anywhere in the universe are on the surface of, no, the Earth. And so what if you want to analyze something from an asteroid in the best known laboratory anywhere in the universe? You have to find a way to go to the asteroid. You have to find a way to reach out and touch the asteroid. You have to pick up a rock. You have to put it in something that keeps it sterile and in the pristine configuration that it was when you picked it up. You know, imagine going, it's sort of like going to buy ice cream for your boyfriend, and it's July, and you come home, you say, here it is, but you forgot that it was July, and it's all melted when it gets home. What good is that? You want to land on an asteroid so you can reach down, pick up stuff, and bring it back to Earth. And take a look at it and understand it. That's why you want to do that. That's part of the reason we want to go to the moon. Because I got rocks from six places. I don't have any from the Grand Canyon. I don't have any from Mount St. Helens. I don't have any from the Rocky Mountains. I don't have any from Vermont. I don't have any sand from the beach. I mean, the only way to get it is go get it. All right, here, and then you're going to moderate so people don't get mad at me.
James Webb Space Telescope.
Yes, Okay, what is the James Webb Space Telescope, what's the schedule, and what's the vehicle that will put it into orbit? It will fly aboard an Ariane 5, which is a ESA French vehicle, be launched out of Kourou, French Guiana. What's the schedule? I can tell you the part of the schedule that I know because the flight mirrors, one of the things we did not do on Hubble, which you probably know, is we never calibrated the system end to end. That's how we got into space, with a mirror that was ground to a curvature that was not the curvature we wanted. And that's why the pictures were fuzzy. That will not happen for the James Webb Space Telescope. The flight mirrors, the James Webb mirrors, they look sort of actually not, I mean, different, but if you look at the panels on the back wall, they're individual panels that make up a surface. They're more arranged like a flower petal, but for the purposes of the room, I don't want to rearrange the panels. You'll have to extrapolate. Each of these flight mirrors are being brought to the Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville to be calibrated. And that parade of 18 flight mirrors starts in December. And we will be calibrating those for the next 2 or 2.5 years. And if I remember correctly, I think the James Webb launch schedule is 2012. And I'm so sad this is on tape because I cannot remember exactly the launch date. But I will get that for you. James Webb is the successor to Hubble. It will operate in deep space, not in low Earth orbit. It will not be serviceable by astronauts. It will operate at 20 degrees above absolute zero. The mirrors are made out of beryllium. And it has to unfold. It has a very sort of elegant unfolding dance that it does to make this big mirror when it launches out of French Guiana. And we did that. I mentioned European partnerships. In exchange for the launch, Europeans will get observing time on the telescope. So there's a sort of a barter system there. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let me say a little bit about commercial space. From my perspective, we would love at NASA nothing more than to buy rides up and down to the space station from a private company in the United States. During the gap, do you know where we have to go to buy rides to the space station? Somebody said Russia. You're right. I don't think that is the best thing. I don't even think it's a good thing, much less the best thing. It's not the kind of thing that a nation that says we're a leading space exploring country does. Can you imagine going to, you know, so-and-so's world-famous pit barbecue and finding out they bought it from Safeway and then they repurposed it and gave it to you? I mean, you can eat it. It works, but it doesn't do much for your image. The administrator of NASA has called that situation unseemly. So there's almost nothing I can say that would supersede what my highest superior in my organization thinks about the situation. We would love, if you have a rocket and you can guarantee me that you can get some folks up and down to the space station, I have a check. It's almost that. There are companies that are trying and there are companies that are making great progress, and I think that's a fantastic thing. As you know, SpaceX launched the Falcon 1 vehicle, their fourth try. They got it. It worked. They got to orbit. That's great. That vehicle is nowhere near the size of what we need to send people into space, but it's a very important first step. Because we don't have that capability, we have to design an architecture that services both the station and helps us go to the moon. And so it's a sort of like Twister, right? Right foot blue, left hand green. It's a little bit not exactly what you might do if you could just say, let's just go to the moon, but we don't have that capability. As soon as one comes online, I know NASA will be eager to take advantage of that. But a commercial market is not one in which the government is the only customer. That's not a market. The government can help catalyze the market. We can help lower the barrier to entry to market. We can help make the balance sheet a little bit easier so that companies might be able to make a little bit of money in the market, but we are not solely just the market maker. So other things have to be done. Lots of folks talk about space tourism. Is that the answer? I don't know. It's out of my price range right now, certainly not out of everybody's. We're going to have to see. But we very, very much want to see in the transportation industry, I'll use an analog, what has happened in the commercial satellite industry. Very first satellite, Wernher von Braun, Charles Pickering, James Van Allen are holding it up. Father of the human space transportation system that took us to the moon, the center director for JPL, and the country's first space scientist, James Van Allen, discovered the Van Allen radiation belts and put the first U.S. satellite in orbit. That was the first one. Now private companies build them for telecommunications companies. They contract a launch on a Delta, and away they go. Government never, you know, maybe the FAA writes a permit or, I don't know, FCC. I'd love to see something like that happen in the transportation industry because that would be a true sign that not only humans have expanded their influence beyond low Earth orbit, but the market has expanded its influence into low Earth orbit, and that's a great thing. Where'd Dr. K go? He ran away. Oh, he's up here. Okay.
When did NASA start development on Orion and Ares?
When did we start development on Orion and Ares? Okay. I came back to the agency in February of 2005, and shortly thereafter, the administrator of NASA initiated what was called a 90-day study. It lasted about twice that long. We didn't change the name. So from that, we got what I would call sort of the first preliminary designs of what the architecture should look like. Traded lots of different launch vehicle options, thought about let's upgrade an Atlas V, can we use a Delta IV Heavy, how many different shuttle-derived architectures can we use. I would sort of say that was the time we started. So sometime in late spring of 2005. Probably really got going a year after that, 2006. So here we are, two plus years later, and we're going to go fly next year. Now, test vehicle, not the full-up vehicle, won't get to orbit. Yes, I understand all that. But the fact that we were able to make as much progress as we have made with the finite resources we have and still fly the shuttle and still get the station going and still land on Mars and still launch the gamma ray burst monitor and still fly by Mercury and still launch a spacecraft to Pluto, not bad. Yes?
That Ares 5 looks really big, really expensive, and you're going to use it one time?
Oh, no, no.
You will reuse it?
Let me clarify. Will we use the Ares 5 one time? Every Ares 5 will be used only once. We will fly multiple versions of the Ares 5. The answer is yes. You can think of that as like the new Saturn 5. Big rocket, lots of capability. It'll fly at most twice a year.
Part of the reason for that is so that you can go from a docking place in low Earth orbit and go further?
The only way to get out of low Earth orbit is to have a rocket on orbit. And the upper part of that Ares 5, it's the last stage, but it's also the stage that you use to do what we call translunar injection. It increases your velocity even more, from like 17,500 miles an hour to like 21,000 miles an hour. You need that extra kick to get further out. Otherwise, you'll just orbit the Earth in low Earth orbit.
Why not use a non-conventional rocket? I have a friend that kind of does research on that.
Mm-hmm.
Why not use
like,
a plasma?
Like electric ion propulsion? Electric ion propulsion is a means of transportation that works great once you're in space. It's not so good for getting this high off the ground. It's very efficient, high thrust, but not high thrust compared to what you need to get off the surface of the Earth. It is really hard to get out of the gravitational well. It's really hard to leave the surface of the Earth.
I was really inspired by the putting a man on the moon, and I remember in second grade, all of my friends wanted to be astronauts.
Mm-hmm.
And you're a great marketer, but you're probably not hitting every single audience. I'm just wondering, is there a plan to market NASA and all of the exciting efforts you're talking about? Because I think there's a huge need in the country to have this kind of symbolic quest. And so what's the answer? Is Hannah Montana on your team?
Can you rephrase the question? There are very serious and very well-specified statutory regulations on what NASA can and cannot do in terms of marketing. Okay, I put that in quotes. The legislation, the Space Act of 1959, that created the agency that gives us our legal existence, there's a clause in there that says part of the agency's mission is to disseminate our results to the widest extent practical. That does not mean I can walk to Congress and go in my congressional representative's office and lobby. That's illegal. I'll go to jail if I do that. I am always free to educate, and I'm always eager to educate, but I am not in a legal position to lobby, to market, to advertise. We don't have to do this. The nation could decide, we're not going to do it. I hope it doesn't. But I don't really feel like I can stand and ethically represent a country and ethically represent the agency if I don't recognize that option is also always on the table. We are discretionary. It's a great thing we live in a country that can do it. The fact that the country can do it is a sign of the vigor and strength of the nation. And so maybe the inverse argument is to the extent that you stop doing it, you reflect the fact that you can't anymore. I think it's very important for people to try to articulate why the country chooses to do it, why? We can never stop answering that question. But that's different than saying, hey, John, why don't you go on Saturday Night Live? And, you know, that's not something I think that's actually in the interest of the agency. This is more of a quest, okay? And you don't market a quest like Coca-Cola.
I had a question about, as you further on the space shuttle, mm-hmm. there's often a lot of experiments that you do for classrooms. There's right. slugs or plants growing. How do you decide what you're? I mean, NASA is doing a lot with the engineering of these rocket building, but also all this other science. I mean, like climate change. Are you studying that as you're so far out? How do you prioritize what experiments to do and what have you learned?
Okay, it's a very good question. So how do we prioritize the science? We have way more good ideas about what experiments we would do than we have money to fund them. Just ask any scientist who's never been funded. This was the best proposal in the lot. They didn't fund it. Science priorities are set in the United States. I'll tell you the area I'm familiar with in astrophysics by something called the National Academy of Sciences. Coincidentally, or maybe not, that was also established by Lincoln in 1863. The National Academy of Sciences, for example, in astrophysics, they survey the entire world, the entire community, everybody who says they're an astrophysicist, and they gather up the whole priority of the community, and they say, tell me what you think we ought to do in the next decade. And they synthesize this, and this process is actually starting now in astrophysics, and they produce something called the Decadal Survey. And it says, we, the esteemed members of the National Academy of Sciences, we believe that in the interest of the nation, these are the top questions in astrophysics that the nation needs to go address, and these are the kinds of missions we would like to see the agency consider, and these are sort of roughly what we think you might want to spend on these missions as a measure of their relative priority. NASA usually takes that advice. It's very good advice. I don't know where you get better advice than from the National Academy of Sciences. It's as sort of crystal clear and non-agenda ridden as I think you can get. And that's one way in which priorities are set. There are also research programs. So we have a research opportunities in astrophysics and space science program, and people submit proposals. And those proposals are against a finite pot of money, and your peers judge your proposals through peer review. So you may write a great proposal, and the community says, here's $100,000, go work. And not so much. You have an old car. You need to be able to get to the office to write a proposal. So, I mean, you know, he's mad at me now. It's okay. I'm just kidding. So peer review in the near term, in the short term, once the global priorities have been sketched out, and then things like the National Academy. And it's not just in astrophysics. They do this in earth science as well. It operates slightly differently in terms of the space station science, but it's another set of peer review where the community makes a value judgment through reading and responding to proposals and balancing that against funding and saying, okay, here's the program. Sorry, I'm not calling on people.
How does NASA relate or...
What? I'll get to both of you. I just let him call. So we'll go here and then, yeah.
How does NASA relate or plan to relate with other international space agencies in other countries?
How do we relate or plan to relate with other space agencies in other countries? Well, we're prohibited from exchanging funds. So we don't like buy stuff from the European Space Agency. We talked a little bit about launching JWST on the rocket, and that's sort of in-kind contributions. We work extraordinarily well with, I will say, every space agency on the planet that we cooperate with. That's a little qualified statement. We don't have a lot of work with the Chinese. But with every other spacefaring nation, we have meaningful and important collaborations going on right now. India, last week, launched a spacecraft to the moon. It carries two NASA instruments. Japan. In my office, we manage a telescope called Hinode. It's a Japanese word for sunrise. It's a solar X-ray telescope, and it's a joint, it's Japanese-led, launched on a rocket from Japan. JAX is, and we're a partner. We're a secondary partner. It's great. It's wonderful. tremendous amount of scientific research coming out of that. At this stage in its life, twice as many refereed journal papers as the predecessor Solar A called YOKO. We work with the Germans on the gamma ray burst monitor in my office. That's a joint U.S.-German activity. Half the day, the folks in Huntsville are controlling and looking at the spacecraft. The other half the day, it's folks in Garching, just outside Munich. If you fly to the Munich airport and take the train downtown, you go right through it. We are collaborating, and again, with the exception probably of the Chinese, with every spacefaring nation in the world, and doing so, I think, in a very robust and healthy way. I cannot tell you what it means to the European community to have a laboratory on the space station, the Columbus Laboratory. It's extraordinarily important to them. They're very proud of it, justifiably so. They built a lot of hardware that you see. When you go out and see it fly over, 40% of the photons bouncing into your eye will have scattered off something that was built by Alenia or built in Germany, maybe the Canada arm. It's critical. We're at the stage now where all the easy stuff has been done. It's very hard to afford to do anything unilaterally. Plus, you know, you don't have all the best minds in the United States. We like to think we do, but you know, you recruit college football teams from all over the country, not just within a 50-mile radius of the school. Why is that? Well, the best players are everywhere. Best minds are everywhere. So you want to bring those together. Yes, sir.
What is the carbon footprint of current and anticipated NASA projects?
What is the carbon footprint of current and anticipated...
The projects you've been discussing tonight.
What is their carbon footprint? I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that question. Not sure how to answer it. Well, in terms of when we launch the space shuttle?
The whole package, there is a carbon footprint, right?
Sure, everything to some extent has a carbon footprint.
It seems to me we need to evaluate those projects with that piece of
information. I mean, we are subject to the same sort of statutory regulations on use of chlorofluorocarbons and you know, other, you know, Here's an example. When we started flying the shuttle, there was a particular kind of insulation that was used that you had Freon to make the insulation. Well, laws got passed. We had to comply with those to change the material, go through requalification, recertification. So we don't have any exemption, with maybe a few exceptions. We're not exempt from the same... And certainly the contracting companies that we use are not exempt from pollution laws and carbon footprint concerns and those kinds of things. I just don't know how I would say what is the carbon footprint of Peoria, Illinois. It's a big, complex thing. And so the carbon footprint of the agency is kind of a big, complex thing, too. I'm sorry, I can't give you a better answer than that. I apologize. Guys, if you got to go, that's great. I'll stay till the cows come home. My plane doesn't leave till 7 o'clock in the morning, so I'm good to go.
I got a question. Are there any new planetary probes on the drawing board to fly after 2010?
Absolutely. We in Huntsville, we manage a program called the Discovery New Frontiers Program, and roughly on two-year centers, we issue a call. The agency issues a call for proposals, and people will propose. Some people want to go to Venus. Some people want to orbit Jupiter. So Juno is a good example of a project that's on the drawing board that's scheduled for launch. That will be an orbiter in the Jupiter system to study the magnetic field of Jupiter, radio emissions, the satellites of Jupiter, its interaction with the solar wind. 2012, I think, is the answer to that question. Hey, you're welcome.
I'm just curious. I don't know if you follow much or you're involved much or know about the sea launch program.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to get basically
Zenit booster going off
a rig.
Considering
something like the Ares rocket that you're trying to put up there, what's the kind of relative payload capacity of a sea launch rocket?
I don't think the Zenit. I think the Zenit booster. You're going to catch me here, but I think it's half as large. 40%, 60% what we need for Ares 1. I tend to think the Zenit booster is certainly smaller than Atlas V or Delta IV Heavy. Maybe it's in sort of the class of Ariane 5. It does not, to my knowledge, have the throw capacity, doesn't have the oomph to take 25 metric tons to the station. And certainly it would not play a role in getting us to the moon. There's just not enough horsepower there. But for commercial satellites and smaller payloads, it's been a great success. I know they had a mishap on the barge or on the platform at one point in time. They got through that. They launched again. Those things happen. That's a joint, I think, is it Boeing and the Russians are together? And the Zenit's a Russian vehicle. They launch off basically a floating oil rig out in the ocean. So you can launch from kind of anywhere where there's water. It's a very, very good idea, and it works. Works great.
I'm not sure if I have the name right, but is NASA still doing any research on scramjets?
On scramjets, hypersonic propulsion. Actually, Larry Huebner should be here. He's sort of the world's expert on that. The answer is yes. Our aeronautics research program is relatively small. There are sort of four buckets into which NASA money flows. Science, which is everything, you know, Hubble, Chandra, planetary missions. Space operations, which is the shuttle and the space station. Exploration, everything I showed up here. And then aeronautics. And aeronautics is, of the four mission directors, it's less than $1 billion a year. Now, that sounds like a lot of money, but that's to feed the entire aeronautics community. So we have had some very successful scramjet tests, hypersonic propulsion tests, where we took a vehicle and dropped it off a B-52 and flew it out over the ocean. Larry Huebner, who works at Marshall Space Flight Center, he's actually working on the one of the new rockets, was one of the program managers for that. And that kind of research, hypersonic propulsion and hypersonics, continues, but at I would say, unfortunately, at a lower level than we might like, just given the budget priorities that we have.
Once the Ares is already developed and it's in operation, is it going to be more or less cost-effective than the shuttle program?
More. It must be more cost-effective. It must cost less to operate than the shuttle. Otherwise, we will not have any money to go build the Ares 5. We have got the shuttle it's a magnificent machine, but it costs almost the same amount whether you fly it or not. That sounds weird, but that's almost true. Ares has to be much, much more cost effective because we want to retire the shuttle and open up that wedge. And with that wedge, we want to build Ares 1, fly Ares 1, build Ares 5, and fly Ares 5 with no significant increase in the overall agency budget. So it absolutely, positively has to be more efficient and more cost effective to operate than the vehicle we're operating now. As an example, did you know it takes a 286 or a 386 computer to test parts on the shuttle? Have you ever seen a 286 computer? Do you know what it looks like? Do you know what a Commodore 64 is? I mean, some of this stuff, I mean, it's just expensive because it's old and it's hard to keep up and it's hard to run and it's inefficient and it takes too long. I mean, if we flew the shuttle for the first time in 1981, when do you think the technology came out? Wasn't 1980, 74, 75, 76, 77. The airframe for Columbia, I think, was started in 76 or 77. So these are old machines. Now, they've been upgraded. They get new avionics. They get new things. But at some point, my 72 Volkswagen Beetle with a Blaupunkt stereo in it, it was still a 72 Volkswagen Beetle. Didn't matter what stereo was like. There's only so much you could do. And so these things have got to be more efficient to operate, more cost-effective. Yes, ma'am.
What are some specific benefits of having information from space? How can we use that here?
Have you ever heard of the ozone hole? Did you watch television today? No? Did you listen to the radio this week? Sirius satellite radio? Did you place a phone call today? What I'm getting at is that I can make a list, you know, as long as the Beatles' list of hit records as to why that's important. And I think, actually, that's part of the problem. It's so everywhere, it's in front of our face, it's hidden in plain sight. You know, the ozone hole. satellites figured out in the mid-80s, I guess, that we were depleting the ozone layer because we were dumping chlorofluorocarbons into the atmosphere. Guess what? It changed our behavior. Fundamentally, you know, my hairspray, it's not an aerosol anymore. It's a pump. I know it looks good, but it's not it's not aerosol anymore. We don't put Freon in our air conditioners anymore. And what we do put in our air conditioners, we try to recapture it. Knowledge about ourselves, about the universe, it fundamentally changes our behavior. You don't remember Apollo 8? Third time we ever flew the Saturn V, we sent three people around the moon. It was pretty sporty. And you've probably seen the video of, you know, they're coming around the backside of the moon, and there's the moon horizon, and up comes the Earth, and they're reading from the book of Genesis. Okay? Did you know that Lyndon Johnson, the President of the United States, I'm at the 100% level this actually happened, took that picture and had a handwritten note to every world leader, including Ho Chi Minh, who was president of North Vietnam. We were at war. Can you imagine that happening today? Can you imagine the president of the United States? What would it take for the president of the United States, pick whoever it is, the one we have now or the one we'll have next week, to write a letter to Ahmadinejad or Bin Laden or face in Venezuela, Chavez, Hugo Chavez, Hugo, man of a thousand faces. That's the kind of stuff that the space program does. You know, you turn on your TV. When I was a kid, Wide World of Sports would come on. It'd say, live via satellite. Like, whoa, that's going on right now in England. Sugar Ray Leonard is boxing. I can see it. How amazing. Now it's like, you know, you the hookup from, you know, I went to Guatemala. I slept in the jungle, this archaeology thing. I had a phone. I called my kids. I was 8 hours from the nearest fresh water supply, but I could call my kids. I could find out if they won their soccer game or not. I mean, to me, that's important. And so it's sort of like the coins. I mean, I think you carry it around every day, and you just don't look at it. You go into 7-Eleven, you buy your Slurpee, you plop your money down, you walk out. But in that transaction is the very fabric of what the country has become. And I think the fabric of who we are and almost everything we see is driven by contributions made through the investments that have been made in the space program.
What can be done to reduce the cost of the space exploration? Can you name one or two challenges, whether it's technical or regulatory?
What can be done to reduce the cost of space exploration? Fly more often. There's a certain fixed cost, and then there's a recurring cost. And if you fly more often, per flight, it gets cheaper. You need simpler vehicles. You need more robust vehicles, fewer parts, higher reliability, more robust, better margins, better design, not testing your flight hardware with a 286 computer. That's one thing. Second thing, I don't know who asked the commercial space question, but to the extent that you can grow a market, price goes down. Competition shows up. The first high-def plasma TV one could buy was probably $10,000. You can get them, I'm sure they're $800, $600 now. First computer. My wife got a scholarship in 1992 or 3, and we bought a honking computer. Really good computer, really good Nanow flex scan monitor, laser printer that knew how to do PostScript. Spent $8,000. Can you imagine what I could get for $8,000 today? I mean, the price goes down. Why? Competition comes in, people innovate, they figure out how to make it cheaper. That's another piece of why I think the commercial space arena is so important. Now, the government's not here to make money. We're not going to be efficient. I'm not going to apologize for that. We're different. We're not a business. We're the government. And the government does things differently for different reasons. Right now, why is the government doing space exploration? because, well, we haven't figured out how companies can justify the investment to make an economic return on their investment. And so that's a whole different model. That's a banana. This is an apple. They're different.
I wonder if you could put in perspective for us what the total budget of NASA is compared to the total budget of the U.S. government.
Okay.
What percentage?
0.6% of the federal budget is NASA. So less than a penny on the dollar. We're about $17 billion a year. We are a third, roughly, of the nation's total space budget. The other two-thirds are in the Department of Defense and in places like the National Security Agency and the NRO and National Geospatial Agency, all the what we call three-letter agencies that you don't hear a lot about. So of all the money the nation spends on space, only a third of it is in NASA.
So when you're talking about huge dollars that we're spending for space exploration, what we're really talking about is pennies on the dollar of the total U.S. budget.
Absolutely. You pay a dollar in federal income tax. Less than a penny of that dollar is invested in space exploration. 0.6 cents, 0.7 cents. And I'll make this point. We don't have cash ejection machines on the space station. It's not like we take that money and then launch it into space. Where does that money go? Well, it pays for... Well, it paid for my suit. You like it? It pays people's salaries, which then I use to pay people to watch my kids, to cook my meals, to do my dry cleaning, to take me on a vacation. That money stays here. It doesn't go to somebody who's selling me a gallon of gas, who doesn't live here, who sort of doesn't care. They just want my money. That's why I call it an investment as opposed to an expense. It's a choice. I mean, we don't have to do it. But when you invest in the space program, I mean, you're feeding families in Huntsville and in Florida. And by the way, that's why Florida is so involved right now in the election. People care. Shutting down the shuttle is a big deal, especially if you work at the Kennedy Space Center and your job is to tighten bolts on the shuttle. No shuttle? What am I going to do? It's a serious concern. And we're working hard to make sure that we mitigate and minimize any sort of disruption in the transition. It's a four-year gap. It's a long time. But all that money is invested, and it's invested here. A lot of it flows to universities to do research. So it pays graduate student stipends, pays professors, buys computers, buys lab equipment. The lab equipment sticks around. You get new knowledge. You grow new crops of PhD students. You get science centers. You get teachers. You get people like me that talk too long when you ask a question. Next question. Yes, sir.
Sorry, me again. You mentioned briefly about like mapping, you know, finding the hole in the ozone layer and whatnot. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of curious in the imagery side of satellite use. How involved is NASA in imagery, or is that mostly, like you said, some of the other three-letter government organizations, or do they do much of the Earth imagery anymore?
We're tremendously involved in imagery. When you go home tonight, turn on the Weather Channel, you'll see Dr. Steve Lyons, severe weather expert, and he'll have a map of the Caribbean behind him if anything's going on. Say, NASA Marshall Space Flight Center Earth Science Office. So some of the folks in my shop are shipping satellite imagery processed data products from NASA satellites to the Weather Channel that you get to see so you can decide whether to take an umbrella tomorrow or not. Mess up your hair, get your clothes wet, whatever. Other things we do with imagery. Some of it's aircraft imagery. Some of it's spaceborne imagery. I'll give you a couple of examples. On the next shuttle mission to launch on the 14th, we're flying something called AgCam, agricultural camera. It's a hyperspectral imager that will be examining the wheat fields of North Dakota. Principal investigator is a scientist named George Seelstadt. He wants to understand what you can do with hyperspectral imaging from space to help farmers in North Dakota understand how to grow a better wheat crop. You need to water, you don't. You have infestation, you don't. You got something going on there, we don't know what it is, but call the doctor because your wheat field is sick. You have very, very good imaging equipment. You beam that information down to the ground, and you do some complex image processing, the details of which I don't understand. I do understand this another example, though, and that was touched upon in the introduction about using spaceborne imaging to find archaeological ruins. This is the most fantastic thing that I have come across in the last 3 or 4 years, and I had the privilege of going to Guatemala and sleeping in the jungle. It was like a Subaru commercial. We got stuck 4 times, winching the truck out of the dirt. It was great. It turns out, if you walk through the Petén region, north and northeastern Guatemala, you can't see 4 feet in front of your face because the foliage is so thick. I could not see Dr. K. If I'm walking through, I just couldn't see him. It's too much, unless he shouts. But he could wear orange, wouldn't matter. So if he's an archaeological ruin, and I'm looking for archaeological ruins, look how close I can get in a country the size of Guatemala and miss it. Okay. Now, Tikal, we can find that. It's sticking up out of the trees. It's huge. Okay, that's, you know, people yelled at Cortez because he was 40 miles away. How could he miss it? You can't see it from the air because all you get is canopy. But the Maya were extraordinarily clever, and they didn't have a lot of rainfall. So what they did was they basically plastered everything with this limestone-based plaster. One part lime, 4 part tree. You cook the lime in the ash, and then you make this plaster. And they used it as the foundation of their structures. So I'm a Neolithic farmer. Neolithic, no, I'm not a Neolithic farmer. I'm a farmer in antiquity, 2,100 years ago, living in the Petén, growing some corn. And I decide I need to make a little shelter for my family to sleep on at night. So I cut down some trees, more on that in a minute. And I make some plaster, and I plaster out a space about this big. Well, life's good for a long time, and then sometime, you know, 800 AD or so, we go from a population density equivalent to modern-day China to nothing in 150 years. We literally fall off the face of the earth. The jungle grows over everything, and now I can't see it, except for one thing. At the end of the dry season, trees get stressed because there's not a lot of water. Trees that grow over dirt compared to trees that grow over the limestone plaster show a different stress signature in the canopy that can only be seen if you're very clever about how you process certain hyperspectral images from space. A farmer in antiquity, 2,100 years ago, modified his environment in a way that I can detect it today from space. In fact, that's the only way I can detect it, unless I stumble across it. Now, what's important about that, other than it's sort of it's like the world's greatest parlor trick, right? I'm not just finding the big structures like Tikal that are sticking out, which tell me, okay, well, that's great. That's how the famous people lived. That's how the really big, important folks lived. I get that. I want to know how you lived and how you lived and where did you keep your dog and where did you dump your trash and how big was your house and did you walk 9 miles to school every day like my grandfather said he did, you know. I don't learn any of that unless I can really do archaeology on a spatial scale equivalent to where the normal humans are. And that's stuff this big. I can see all of it. I can GPS register my image, and I can walk through the jungle, and I can say, okay, I should see architecture in 30 feet, 20 feet. Remember, I can't see squat. 10 feet, 5 feet, holy cow, there it is. The site at San Bartolo, which is in the Petén, if you ever go there, you need permission from the Guatemalan government, but if you ever go there, that thing lights up like a Christmas tree from space. So I was there last summer, and they were investigating some really interesting linear features, long, long lines that they see in the satellite data. I'm like, what is that? We go out. Irrigation ditches. The extent to which the Maya were farming corn in the Petén is unbelievable. You stand on the top of a pyramid at Tikal, and it's just jungle as far as you can imagine. 2,000 years ago, there was not a tree in sight. It was all corn. That whole landscape, everything about it, human-induced. You walk through, you think it's natural. The way it looks the way it is because people tore it down, and that's what grew back. Those are the kinds of things you can learn with imagery from space, among other stuff, like the hurricane's coming, you better get out of the way. Practical things like that, not just, what was that Neolithic? I keep seeing Neolithic. It's not right. Farmer in antiquity. I don't know why that word keeps coming out.
All right. Now, if I wanted to go on vacation to space, mm-hmm. what would I have to do and how much would that cost?
If you wanted to go on a vacation to space, there are several kinds. Richard Garriott just returned from the International Space Station within the past few days. He spent 9 days there. It cost him about $30 million. $30 million for 9 days. Hmm? So there are 86,400 seconds in a day. So let's say there are 100,000 seconds in a day. So he was up there for less than a million seconds, right? 100,000 seconds, 10 days, million seconds, $30 million, $30 a second. 1,001, 1,002, 1,003. You just blew $100. You better get going. Okay, so that's one. You can also take sort of flea hops into space, and that's coming. Richard Branson and Virgin Galactic will team with Burt Rutan, and I think that's $100,000, $100,000, last 5 minutes. You go up, you come down. You don't go to orbit. You have about 1% of the energy put into your body on a flight like this as you do on a flight that goes around the Earth. But it costs less than one. It costs 1/3% of the total. So, you know, per joule of energy put into your body, you can calculate that too. But all day I dream about space. That's what Adidas stands for. Yeah, a year over in Russia at Star City. There's a company called Space Adventures that will be happy to take your check. I think they require cash up front, though. You can't pay them on the back end. Yeah.
One of my friends was telling me about getting energy from helium-3 on the moon. I don't know if you could tell me more about that.
Helium-3 is a product of fusion in the sun. The theory goes like this. It's been streaming out of the sun for 4.65 billion years, 4 billion years. Pick your cosmology. And the lunar soil has been collecting it. Now, you can fuse helium-3. If you can fuse helium-3, I should say, it's extraordinarily clean. It's very clean. Not a lot of radiation, these kinds of things. But in theory, it's a very clean fuel source. In theory, it should be embedded. There should be a historical sort of geologic record of helium-3 as it's been streaming out of the sun, preserved in the lunar regolith. If you can go to the moon, if the helium-3 is there, which it should be, if you can extract it, if you can fuse it, and if you can get the energy out, it would be a great energy source. Now, that's a lot of ifs, and I'm not trying to be pejorative. It could happen. It's just not the first thing we're going to try when we get there. And do you know what helium-3 is? Helium is it's the second element in the periodic table. Has two protons. That's what makes it helium. Usually it comes with two neutrons, so it has an atomic weight of 4. But helium-3 has one of the neutrons stripped away. So it's two protons and a neutron in the nucleus. Confuse them and get energy out. One behind you.
Dr. Horak?
Jack.
Does NASA have anything to do with the Space Elevator Project? Are you familiar?
Does NASA have any
theory? Because isn't Japan just... I thought I read something that Japan had just said they were going to look into this as mm-hmm. far as a way of entering space.
The answer to the first question is not really, but sort of. And the second question is yes. Is NASA involved in the Space Elevator Project? from time to time people will get calls, or you know, somebody will have a spare Saturday and they'll write a paper on it, or they'll go to a conference on really future concepts in space and they'll talk about it, sort of. Am I aware of it? Absolutely. You know, so the idea that you can basically have this big rotating kind of tether in space, and you just put it in space, you start rotating it, and as the at one end of the rope dips down in the atmosphere, you grab on. That's rotating. Or you can also sort of this concept that you just orbit this mass and you stick two ropes out of it. Well, your balance is going to orbit, but the one rope is down here and you literally just climb it like an elevator. And the engineering behind that is extraordinarily difficult. The material science that would be required to build some, to actually build, I mean, you, the physics, that's an example of something that works great in physics class, and you have no idea how to even start the problem in engineering class, the difference between physics and engineering. Explain how it could work. Well, all physics is all, it's actually extraordinarily straightforward. It's a freshman physics problem. It's an engineering problem we don't know how to solve. So there's a dislocation there between the physics and the engineering. If you could get there, you wouldn't have to use rockets to get into space.
Yeah, one of the things you said you wanted to do with the Saturn V was to go to the poles of the moon and see if there's like ice or something there.
Mm-hmm.
I was just wondering if there's some kind of temperature factor that would make that harder to operate near the poles versus mm-hmm. the equator.
Yeah, the moon is interesting. If you go out and look at the moon, it looks the same every night, same face towards you every night. You never see the backside of the moon. So if this is the Earth, the moon goes around the Earth like this. Always, never turns its back on you. It doesn't trust us. Well, the sun and so the moon orbits in a plane, and to within the about 7 degrees, that plane is also the same plane that the Earth goes around the sun. So everything's in the same plane. So if I stand on the north pole of the moon, what do I see? I see the sun go like this. It's sort of to first order, never rises, never sets. You thought you'd get away from me. Welcome to physics class. All right, so here's the sun. Here's the Earth at the equinox. Kind of here's the moon, and the moon goes around like this, right? So if I'm standing up here, you know, the sun is always perfectly on the horizon. And if I'm standing down here, the sun is perfectly on the horizon. If I'm on the equator, it's always high in the sky. But it rises and sets. But the moon's not a cue ball. It's not a billiard ball. There are craters and mountains. So there are places near the poles of the moon, if you're on the top of a mountain, the sun never sets. If you're in the bottom of a crater, you never see the sun. It's permanently shadowed. So in that permanently shadowed region, the temperature is going to be as low as 20 degrees above absolute zero, 20 degrees Kelvin. Maybe 200 and some odd degrees on top of the mountain. Now, the sunlight's not direct. You know, the sun beating down on your head in Florida is a lot different than if you go up to Winnipeg. It's just different because the sun's lower in the sky. So, you know, near the equator, if you stay for a month, you get 14 days of sunlight followed by 14 days of darkness. It's really hard to build something that will survive many of those temperature cycles. Electronics, all that kind of stuff. If you can put it on top of a mountain near the pole, you get the same thermal environment all the time. This the sun's heating you from this side one half the month, and it's heating you from this side the other half the month. So in a sense, if you can find that place, you need a really good map, because the space might only be less than a kilometer in extent. You need a really good map. You better know how to land with really, really good precision, because you miss. Oops, I landed in the dark. I meant to land here, and I landed just on the other side of campus. What's the difference? It's the difference between your hardware working and having no chance. And I don't know how, you know, going down in the crater where there's no sunlight, that's an interesting place. Because there's no sunlight, if comets are bombarding the moon, maybe they're depositing water. And there's nothing to boil it off. So over 4.5 billion years, you might collect a reasonable amount of water. Boy, it'd be great if there was water on the moon. It cost me $10,000 a pound to take it to the space station. What do you think it cost me to take a gallon of water to the moon? How many gallons of water do 4 people use for 6 months? A lot. If I don't have to carry that with me, thank you. Sometimes I subscribe to the cruel God theory. Of course there's no water there. It'd be too easy. So we want to go down in the crater. The first attempt we're going to make is next year, sort of. There's a satellite called LRO, Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, and has another piece on the rocket called Lunar Crater Observation and Sensing Satellite. It's basically a smart upper stage on the Atlas V, and we're going to slam it into the crater. What happens? Lots of stuff gets shot up. And then they're going to fly through the ejecta and see if there's any water there. We're going to look at it from the ground, see if we can find water. Is there water on the moon? That's a big question. It's not going to be, we know, we've been there. It's not in this area. There's no water here. How do we know? Armstrong, Aldrin, Cernan, Duke, they walked around. We brought stuff back. There's no water at the equators. But there might be water at the poles. That's why we want to go to the poles. Lots of reasons, but that's kind of a picture of why the poles are very interesting. We couldn't get there with a Saturn V. We didn't have the throw weight, didn't have the capability. It takes more energy to get to the poles in terms of your rocket engines and the orbit trajectories you need to fly and those kinds of things than to get to the equator. Much more energy in some cases. So that's why we need a bigger rocket. I'll stay all night. But, yeah.
So does NASA do like sociology research and with their astronauts, and how do you train your astronauts to deal with those kind of situations, like being on the moon together, being in the space station together, or all those kinds of things?
Sorry, that was a statement. But
so
I heard
how
it
do
as
you
a
how
statement.
do you train? Does they do that kind of research?
Oh.
And how do you train?
Yeah. I had the pleasure of. And I mean that sincerely, of being a finalist for the astronaut program in 1998. Every year, every time they go through it, 5,000 people apply, they interview 100, they pick 25 the year I went. So I was in that other set. First thing that happens when you show up in Houston for the week, you get an 8-hour psychiatric test, written exam, questions, some you don't have any idea why they ask you, would you like to arrange flowers as a career? That's a question on the test. You're like... no. Yes. What do they want me to say? And then there's the medical thing. Have you ever had tuberculosis? Have you ever lost a limb in a farming accident? Have you ever had a, you know, all the way down? Have you ever had vision in both eyes? On. And you're just like, no. Have you ever had vision in both eyes? No. Wait a minute. That one in there. Okay. There is a tremendous amount of research, work, I'll say genuine human concern, appropriately placed for the astronauts, and not only for the astronauts, but for their families. Imagine your father sitting on the space shuttle. You and your brother and your sister and your mother are standing there. How do you feel? It's thrilling. It's scary. It's probably all of that all bundled up, and we take care of them. We try really hard to take care of them. The psychological and psychiatric, if I can use that word, screening health concerns of the astronauts are paramount. They think very carefully about what crews and the compatibility of the crew. And those are questions that are going to have to be explored in more detail. And even when they come back, I mean, it's... I can't imagine what it's like to fly in space for 6 months and then come back down and have to do your laundry or drive your kids to school. I mean, you know, I was just on the space station and now I'm in 7-Eleven buying milk and eggs and grass needs to be cut. Life goes on. That's hard. It can be really hard. And, you know, I think you can do research on how some of the astronauts that came back from the moon dealt with that. That was hard. But those questions get exacerbated as I was kind of kidding over there. You four have to spend 24 months in a can with each other. And there's no getting away. We have to really, I mean, we have to think about that. So maybe that's a good segue into one final point I'll make, and that is that I was privileged. I was an astrophysicist. I did some really cool space science research, built a detector this big, can see all the way across the universe. But that's not the only way to be a part of this investment. Psychiatrist, journalist, chef. We got to feed people on the space station. How do you cook? How do you, you know, you can be a propulsion engineer, propulsion physicist, accountant. It takes all kinds. It looks like America. The Marshall Space Flight Center looks like the mall. All shapes, all sizes, all flavors of people, all kinds of silly outfits, fancy outfits, cars in the parking lot, or everything from, you know, some guy decided he wanted a really nice car and it's parked next to a car that should be on blocks. I mean, it's America. It's America. So don't feel like, you know, if this is something that you feel like, yeah, it might be cool to work in a space program. Yeah, it helps to take some science classes. It helps to be math inclined. That's not necessarily required. You start off the night. We don't have enough people that can tell the story. Where do we go to get people who can educate people who are interested about this? Teachers, scientists, astronauts, pilots. Yeah, we got all those. But we need sociologists. We need psychiatrists. We need everybody. So I'll stay, but maybe we should kind of draw the formal. They're out of videotape anyway, I'm sure, up there. So thank you. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you.